Professors FM.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Fanalytics Podcast. Mike Lewis, Doug Battle. Well, Doug, it's the happiest time of year. The NCAA tournament is right around the corner. The best, I mean, past years we've talked about it as the best fan tournament in all of sports. I don't think there's any, I don't think there's actually much debate about that if you're sort of serious about it, the purity of the fans, the enthusiasm of the fans. But, you know, college sports is in a different environment these days with NIL changing the landscape dramatically across, you know, men's college football and men's college basketball. This past couple of weeks, there's been congressional hearings, in fact, with Nick Saban making the media rounds talking about NIL as at least a contributor of having him, you know, think about moving on as one of the reasons for him moving on from college football and from Alabama. Saban proposed the idea of a revenue sharing system, obviously hates the current form of these collectives. The collectives are, I mean, I don't even know what you say about the collective. The collectives are bizarre, right? So the colleges make tons of money on these, on football in particular, some money on men's college basketball. And, you know, a lot of the moralizing or the logic of paying the players is the players should share in those revenues. So we now have a system where the colleges are not sharing those revenues with the players, but they're helping to organize groups of donors who then pay the players separately. The colleges are clearly the winners in all this, but it's a obviously unstable system.
Right. And initially it seems like NIL, the idea wasn't to have anyone directly paying the players on behalf of the university, whether it's boosters or the college itself, but to simply have brand partnerships where the players are adding marketing value to local business or national business, and that money is what goes to the players. So these whole collectives, I don't think that they are part of the original intent of NIL. And at that point, it's really just kind of a fundraiser to see who can buy the best team, which recently it looks like Ohio State and maybe Ole Miss are two of the top players. I would expect Texas A&M in the future.
I didn't hear Illinois.
Yeah, no. Illinois. Nebraska, they got Dylan Raiola. So,
Nebraska. Nebraska, yeah.
Yeah, I think at the point where you have
remember when this all first came out, and it was part of the logic was that these kids, like the swimmer could go give swimming lessons over the summer, right? Or the gymnast could run a camp back at their high school.
Which is great. Yeah, I think that's all great. I think at the point where you have a collective that's not the university, but the university's organizing, that is directly paying players for no, to my understanding, there's no marketing, there's no exchange in terms of the player providing an external service that's an auxiliary to their performance on the field or on the court, but it's simply just for the performance on the court. At that point, I'm like, okay, why don't we just pay players like it's the NFL or like it's the NBA?
Yeah. Well, Saban was interesting, right? He said that basically it's come out that that's now the first question that every recruit asks or transfer, I gather. Of how much can I get from your collective? And even that's a weird structure, right? So they're asking Saban, who doesn't control the collective, right? So I guess Saban has to,
or if there's someone in
the coach that then goes to the collectives, the amount of coordination has got to be pretty staggering and how closely they're working together.
And I think someone in Nick Saban's shoes, their job is already kind of like a GM in the sense of they're assembling a team and they got to manage the roster. But now you're talking about you're managing this money that's not yours. It's not really the school's. It's kind of the school's. And you're deciding, do we give the safety the $2 million he's asking for? Or do we?
I guess after you pay for your Georgia tickets, well, actually, Doug, I mean, so I think the system is this. You make a donation to Georgia, right? Which allows you to buy tickets.
Yep.
And then you also need to contribute to the collective to sign the players.
I got to say that, like, the universities have to be kind of laughing about this setup because They're essentially getting other people to pay for their workforce, and people are gladly doing it. They're happy to
fighting with each other.
Yeah, they're seeing who can give the most. So I think it's brilliant on behalf of the universities. I don't think they're going to get away with it for forever. I think at some point we will face the reality that, you know, this is generating revenue for the schools, and they're going to be the ones that are bidding on these players, maybe more so than their boosters or the local businesses of Auburn, Alabama.
Well, I'm not going to be a I don't want to be a I told you so guy, but I remember when all this was shaking out, right? The highlighting the issue of there's a lack of a collective bargaining agreement, right?
You did. Yep, I remember.
There's no structure in place for organizing the workforce with management. So you can propose a revenue sharing agreement. I have no idea what that means. So who's going to share revenues with who? Is Alabama football going to share it with the Alabama equestrian team, or are they going to share it with Louisiana Tech? Because I don't think long term the Alabama football team is going to share it with any of those entities. Unless, currently forced to via Title IX. But as this becomes, you know, look, we had the unionization effort at Dartmouth basketball. As we can, I got to think it's inevitable. As players become employees, the amount of sharing, and this is going to bother a lot of people, the amount of sharing is actually going to decrease until something happens and we have a big two. It's like, can we skip towards the end, Doug? We got two conferences, the Big Ten, and we got the SEC, and they have in some mechanisms like the pro leagues that essentially ensure some level of competitive balance.
Yeah, so there's not a collective bargaining agreement. There's also hardly any enforcement of the legalities that are in place, which has been a huge contributing factor in NIL really kind of being a Trojan horse for pay for play. I mean, it was pretty predictable, but the one thing that could prevent that is the NCAA laying down an iron fist. And when there's violations, when there's tampering, for example, I've heard many cases of tampering that are more than verified. And it's just like, what are you going to do about it? And then when nothing's done, then all the other schools look at each other and they're like, well, we're at a disadvantage if we're not tampering, you know, if we're not shopping players on the other team's roster during the season after the game when we're shaking hands. And so it's the Wild West still with NIL. You know, college sports and particularly college football.
Well, hold on, Doug. I got a question.
It feels like it's always in a state of change. Like now they're talking about a 14-team playoff. NIL's still kind of in flux. The whole thing is just chaos.
Transfers. Okay, so here's a question for you. The transfer portal has made everyone a free agent every year, right?
Yeah.
Can the collective start asking people to sign contracts?
It might be a good thing for the sports. It might be a good thing for the fans.
A player will potentially have a four-year marketing contract with Alabama Football Collective, and so they can't violate. It doesn't make sense, right?
I'll tell you this. They started selling the jerseys when NIL became a thing because they can put the players' names on the back now and they can compensate the players, even though they make like hardly anything from it.
Hey, bring up remember when, was it Central Florida, I think, put the players, like, they put the players' Twitter handles on the back of their jerseys and Instagram jerseys?
Yeah, it was UCLA, Gus Malzahn. Yeah, a little gimmicky, but why not? But yeah, now you can buy a player's jersey, but I'm not one to buy a current college player's jersey, but if I were, be real hesitant in this day and age because you're buying $100 jersey and your favorite player, Justin Fields, if I'm a Georgia fan, I was given a number one Georgia jersey when Justin Fields that Christmas, so right before the bowl game, and then a couple of weeks later Justin Fields is gone and it's like, well, that's the last jersey I want to have now. And so I don't know, things like that are a little bit complicated. It might benefit from having contracts between players and the schools. I can't imagine contracts longer than 3 years for these guys either.
No. So I don't know where it goes, but it's clearly got to go somewhere. as we start to talk about transfers, you know, that brings us, like I said, back to God, Doug, you know, I watched more college basketball, men's college basketball this past weekend than I have the rest of the season. Okay. So, you know, let's be honest. It is not the same game that it was in past generations, right? You could argue that when Larry and Magic were playing, that two of the five best basketball players in the world were competing in the NCAA. You can argue that when Michael Jordan was a junior at North Carolina, he was the best basketball player in the world in the NCAA. But you know what, Doug? It's not a bad product. You've got the rivalries. You've got a lot of things going for it. Now, I will say this. So, I mean, like, I thoroughly enjoyed the Big Ten tournament. The Japanese Steph Curry was a lot of fun to watch. But I'll say this. For my team, I'll go fanboy mode for a second. I think there's one player that does significant minutes that was recruited as a high school player on that team. Everyone else is a transfer. So they also tend to shoot themselves in – they're not getting the media attention for whatever reason, but they're also shooting themselves in the foot because I barely connect to these guys because I don't have, you know, 3 years of recruiting and then 3 years in the program. It's just they're mercenaries.
Yeah, it does have a mercenary feel. My family are all Virginia fans, so we watched a good bit of the ACC tournament, and they would complain about, you know, well, that so-and-so who plays on NC State, he used to play for Virginia, and if we had him, you know, it's a different ball game, and we would be winning. And like they were just gypped by this whole thing. And I'm like, you do realize every school has that. Like Georgia, my alma mater, Katie Johnson, I was watching Auburn yesterday, and one of Auburn's better players. And, you know, he's a transfer from Georgia. Everyone's from everywhere. There's not, I will say this, there's the lack of connection with the players. But in terms of the actual on-court product, there is a lack of continuity. These guys haven't played together for a long time. And I think that is a major reason why I loved college basketball growing up, was because I watched Ty Lawson and Tyler Hansbrough and Wayne Ellington and Danny Green. Like, I watched these guys on one team for several years, and you had more continuity at the time in college than you did in the NBA, because the NBA, it was like, oh, those guys get traded. You know, I viewed them as the mercenaries, but college was where nobody left their school and nobody was jumping around. And so that lack of continuity, in addition to the lack of talent, where you don't have maybe the top basketball player in the world or one of the top five basketball players in the world playing at the college level like you do in football and like you used to in basketball, you also don't have the same continuity that you used to have. And so to me, the product as a whole is significantly diminished. But I will say this. I think that everyone is kind of not that great, and I think it does open the door for more chaos than usual in March. And so I'm thinking it's going to be a really wild March, and I am looking forward to that.
I think you're right. When I look at the top seeds in the men's bracket, I don't have any particular faith that we're going to see UConn versus Purdue in the finals. It doesn't seem like that's the system. I was going to add one thing to what you're talking about, the continuity with the players. You know, over time, we've also seen this shift towards much more national recruiting. You know, for a team like Illinois, typically the players were almost all from Illinois, or at least half from Illinois. So these are guys that were playing high school together. I mean, so you really did have these long-term narratives structured where, you know, you knew about some kid and, you know, going to King High School as a ninth grader, and you could watch him, you know, get ready and then hit the college scene at Illinois. All that's gone. But again, man, I enjoyed it, Doug. I enjoyed sort of getting back into college basketball. I'll also add that I think they've kind of shot themselves a little bit in the foot with March Madness. They've removed all the drama from the system by essentially – and look, I can't even keep it straight. I don't know if analytically it makes a lot of sense of being concerned with your quad two wins versus your quad three loss, right?
Right.
But, I mean, there's little drama in terms of – the seeding and who's getting in. On a personal level, we adopted a new favorite player, right? Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, or Larry.
We've been robbed, Mike. We've been robbed of an excellent March. So Indiana State gypped, left out of the tournament. And that's a huge gripe of mine over the years is teams that lose their conference tournament, lose one game late in the season, and that game counts way more than all the other games they could have lost. If they lost that same, you know, to the same team earlier in the season, they'd be fine now. It was last year, and I'm a UAB guy. I'm from Birmingham, and they're in the tournament this year. Watch out for the Blazers. But last year, you know, they had a great season, and it doesn't matter. If you're a team like UAB, you could go 0-24, but if you win your conference championship, you're in. And it's possible that you go, you know, 24-0 or 21-3 or what. Yeah, you have a really great record in the season. And if you lose in that opening round or even in the final, as I believe was the case last year for UAB, you're in the NIT, you're out. And so the season doesn't matter for those teams nearly as much. And Indiana State is a great example of that. And I am still upset. I love seeing the team. You know, I saw a team where the coach was fired after the regular season, and then he was allowed to coach in their conference tournament, and then they won their conference tournament, and now they're in the big dance. Like, I love those stories. I think it's fun, but I also feel like the system really robs us of seeing the top 68 teams. And I don't think there's really any debating that.
Okay, but can we reach a consensus, and we don't need to, that we are rooting for the Nebraska Cornhuskers for a bunch of reasons. Okay, so I referenced, like, I'm rooting for Illinois, but I was also rooting for Kasei Tominaga, the Japanese Steph Curry. He's a really fun, interesting player to watch. And I think the other thing that adds to it, Doug, is he's doing it for Nebraska, right? Nebraska doesn't play basketball.
Nebraska.
Yeah, Nebraska doesn't play basketball. They play football. And in 2024,
well, they used to play football.
Nebraska, yeah, in 2024, Nebraska is a women's volleyball team and a men's basketball team with their key talent coming from Japan. That's fun.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to pick against. I'm actually pulling up my bracket right now. I got to make sure I pick Nebraska because I've said it 100 times on the show. I feel like in hindsight, every year I look at the stories that come out of March and I'm like, how did I not see that? And so now when I'm picking my upsets or I'm picking my teams to go on a run, I just go for the best stories on the bracket. And I'm going down my list, Mike. I got to tell you a couple upsets I got. I got Florida Atlantic going really far again. Let's see. Going
Why?
Down.
Do you have a reason?
Yeah, they got a bunch of seniors. They're a veteran-led team that made it far in the dance before. And their bracket, you know, I mean, that second round, they would be playing UConn, which would be a pretty big upset. But I'm going with it. Like I said, I feel like nobody's that good this year, and so it opens the door for some chaos. I had Charleston going to the Sweet 16. All of these takes are probably going to backfire if you listen to the show in like a week. But nonetheless, I like to have fun with it. New Mexico in my Sweet 16 at the moment. I mean, these are subject to change. Let's see. McNeese in my Sweet 16. I had Akron over Creighton in the first round. I like Samford over Kansas. You know why? Because I used to play a school called Mountain Brook growing up, and their head coach, their varsity team, is now the coach of Samford. And everyone in Birmingham knew about this guy because we were all like, you know, why is he not coaching college basketball? But at Mountain Brook, they called it Buckyball. He had his own style of basketball called Buckyball. And I heard ESPN say that word the other day, and I was like, "Oh, they're about to shock the world because that is just the
unleash Buckyball."
That's just the kind of thing that, you know, just that phrase. Like, it's one of those things. In hindsight, I'll be like, "How did I hear the phrase Buckyball and not pick an upset?" I got Western Kentucky making a little run, James Madison. So I'm going for chaos this year. I think that the door is wide open for some of these mid majors. I think there's also a lot of teams that are overhyped because of playing legacy brand teams that aren't good. And like the football equivalent would be like a win over Nebraska. Kind of people are like, well, it is Nebraska. I mean, they've got a lot of history, or win over Notre Dame or whatever. You know, I think there's a lot of basketball programs that are big brands that have fallen off, and beating those teams still means a little bit more than beating UAB or Florida Atlantic or you know, a program that's really playing good ball right now. And so I think that, you know, I think some of the mid-majors are going to have a lot of fun this week. And that's what I look for in the first weekend of March. First weekend of March Madness is my favorite weekend, probably in the sports calendar, maybe, you know, with the exception of the Super Bowl.
You know what I don't know, though, Doug, is I don't know how the media is covering the men's and the women's tournaments this year. You know, because, I mean, traditionally it has been that on the first day of the tournament, the first 2 days of the tournament, right, it's basketball fan paradise, oh, right? Yeah. Suddenly, oh, there's basketball games. There's a basketball game on, you know, TLC or something, right? That they you start to understand the structure of media because suddenly, you know, there's six channels that used to just do, you know, oh, here's a couple looking to buy a house in Maui, and suddenly, you know, you got Duke playing, you know, Seton Hall or something.
Vermont, yeah.
So, but I don't know what it's going to look like, but it will be a lot of fun from my perspective to see. And I love what you're doing, talking about the underdogs, the potential narratives that are coming out of this. Obviously, I think ESPN is the dominant sports media outlet, has done a relatively lousy job in terms of preloading the narrative. So they're going to have to develop these on a fly and blast them out strong for this tournament to start to resonate with the more casual viewers. I do want to add one other thing, though, in terms of the Japanese Steph Curry. Not that I'm obsessed. He also wears a headband. I mean, yes. That headband's right up there with your point about the mustache and the goggles. He's
another one. I saw him earlier in the year, and I was like, all right, I got to bookmark this for March because there's no way they're not going on a run. I'm going to have to do a video later in the week because I've started researching my Cinderellas. Obviously, I mentioned several, but I got to go through the team roster, like the team photos, and find the mustaches because that is the key in picking a March Madness bracket. There's always a white guy with an epic stash.
Usually
a big man.
Well, but and also a senior, right? Someone with some deep experience.
You know, speaking of deep experience, one of the reasons I think that the current landscape paves the way for these Cinderellas is that I think there's less turnover at some of the mid-majors than there is. Like Alabama, Auburn, Georgia, like the kind of regional teams where we are. And then also just looking at North Carolina, and it's like, oh, one of their best players is now at Arizona, and Baylor, one of their best players is now at Houston, and the guys are jumping all over the place at that level because there's so much money, and because, you know, I don't know. I think because they have the world of opportunities every offseason, and it's easy to lure guys. But like I said about Florida Atlantic, you don't see a lot of schools with five guys that are three-year starters or five guys that, you know, played in a long run in the tournament together before. And so I think that you tend to see that more with the mid-majors. You tend to see a lot more seniority because you got less guys going pro early. And so I think that that's part of the magic in March and part of the reason why we see some of the things that we do. And again, those are all things that I look for when I'm when I'm picking my bracket. Of course, there is a level of randomness as well.
I'll sort of agree with you, right, on that. Like the age of the superstar seems to be over. Right.
Yeah.
You know, getting that top five player, that top 10 player seems to be meaningless. That 18-year-old, just unless it's, you know, the generational talent like Zion, doesn't seem to mean a lot. Right. The adjustment process, or maybe the fact that they're really just putting in time to go to the NBA. There's an issue there. But the point about the mid majors is interesting to me because Illinois, again, not to be too much of a fan specific, but you know, their top two players, one came from Texas Tech, and I think the other one came from Southern Illinois University. So we've got a very strange structure where, hey, this guy's killing it at the mid-major level. I want that fifth, and so in some ways, that fifth year mid-major guy, that's the king of college basketball, right? That physically mature 22, 23, Stetson Bennett, 24-year-old, right? That adult man is the key to success in college sports at the moment.
Well, you look at college football in recent years, Stetson Bennett, obviously a great example. Last year, Michael Penix Jr., a guy who played a lot of football, Bo Nix, a guy who's felt like he was in college since I was, and I think I missed him by a year maybe, but these guys, you know, schools are benefiting from having the kind of guys that stick around. And as a fan, when I'm looking at Georgia recruiting, I almost get more excited for a four-star quarterback who's doesn't quite have an NFL arm. He's 6 foot tall and he's not that mobile, but man, he's a ball player, because you can just see that kid and for 4 years or even in year four,
Doug, let's make it
college football, and you don't have to worry about them going pro. But when it's a, you know, Raiola, you're like, well, you might have, you know, some developmental years where they're making all their mistakes and then they go pro before you get to reap the benefit.
Well, let's, I mean, look, football and basketball are kind of separating, I think, in terms of their structures, right? As soon as the NCAA men's basketball went to, you know, essentially, oh, you can go straight from high school to the draft and then the one and done system. It's almost like they cut their own throat. But if I'm looking at things as a college basketball coach, I don't even know if I'm recruiting high school kids at the moment, right? Because Inevitably the high school kids, if they don't end up playing a ton their freshman year, it's almost like if they don't end up being one and dones, they're going to move on to another program where they think they're going to be featured and then be a two and done. I'm almost just adopting to this notion that, look, I'm not going to have a lot of guys that are going to go to the league, but I'm going to have a lot of fifth year, genuine, mature physical specimens playing against you every year. And I'm going to take the best guy from, look, it turns out the best guy from Southern Illinois was better than any high school kid out of the state of Illinois last year. And I suspect that's reality.
I think it's a great point. I think that, you know, especially if you're a team that has some depth or your starters cut out, like mostly, because again, something you see in college sports quite a bit is in college football, particularly in my, you know, from what I follow the most, you'll see like Georgia last year, they had a really good recruiting class of receivers. They also had, you know, several NFL guys at receiver that were juniors and seniors. And so those freshmen were developing a practice and you know, ready to fill in when needed, but not called upon often. And there were several of them that transferred after the season because they felt like, you know, I'm good enough to be out there, and they are. And, you know, there's another school that's going to value me more. But then if you're the coaching staff at Georgia and you did all the workouts, you worked on their technique, you helped them learn the playbook, you invest in these guys, and they're highly likely to be leaving. Whereas, and then you're just filling in and you're going to the transfer portal and you're getting some junior from Miami or from Mississippi State or from Missouri or wherever to come in and fill the gap. And it's like, I can certainly see how it would discourage really recruiting at the high school level when such a high percentage are going to leave in the developmental stages before you're reaping the benefits of their development.
Well, it may legitimately be the case that the sure things, you know, those 20 or 40 guys that have pro potential are not worth recruiting, right? And this is long and true, right? There's different ways to win the NCAA tournament, right? You can have a bunch of top five, top 10 guys like Duke and Kentucky, or you can have a senior point guard, right? That's played a lot of minutes, but he's a little undersized, so he can't go to the league.
Yeah.
And you've got some journeyman guys that like to, you know, that they're physical players, but again, maybe lack the skills. And so if you're adapting to this route number two, then transfers probably make more sense than anything else. We're moving towards one of the showcases of college sports. Very different from I didn't used to think it was all that different, but now, you know, the glamour, the media attention on college football has really caused these sports to feel very separate to me, Doug. But like I said, for the college basketball, this is it. Next 3-4 weeks, right? This is the whole, it's like the Christmas season for retailers, right? This is the whole show.
Yeah. And I'll say this just to kind of counter the argument we've been making, or to present the counter argument as far as taking transfers. Something I've heard and something that I kind of, I guess, kind of wrestle with as a fan is, you know, when you're building a team of transfers, are you taking the kind of guy who gives up or who would leave his teammates high and dry, or who would, is a me guy, you know, who's looking out for numero uno? Because I really am a big fan of the guys that stick it out and that wait their turn. Like Carson Beck at Georgia, quarterback, waited his turn. I would much rather have a fourth-year guy who's waited his turn than a freshman five-star, or even a transfer quarterback who's a Heisman favorite or whatnot. And so it's like, going with those transfers, are you always going to have a group of guys that aren't team first? Not saying that every transfer is that way, but certainly seems to be a tendency for the team first guys to kind of stick with their initial school. And maybe it's hard to sort those guys out when you're recruiting high schoolers, but that's the ultimate goal.
Let's bring this full circle then. That guy that's sitting on the bench waiting his turn is throwing away millions of dollars potentially. And yeah. So that high character, I know what you're saying, but and so like that high character guy that's like part of the program bleeds orange and blue or red and black.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all want him. But the system now doesn't facilitate him, you know, those choices are financially disastrous for it. Like, I mean, Carson, we don't know the compensation of any of these guys, but Carson Beck is now, I think, for a guy that doesn't get a lot of hype, I've seen stuff that has him listed as the number one or two pro prospect coming into college football last year. So, you know, there's this kid at Texas, right, that isn't going to see the field the first couple of years that makes a ton of money, you know, the Manning, what's his name? Arch Manning. Arch. Okay. And so it's great, right? Arch Manning, most hyped recruit, maybe in the history of college football, getting paid. So could Carson Beck, how much money did he throw away by not going to a place where he was the day one starter?
Carson Beck or Arch
Carson
Manning?
Carson Beck.
Okay. I was going to say Arch Manning didn't lose too much. I think short term Carson probably lost quite a bit, but in hindsight, I think he could have been the day one starter at like Florida,
yeah,
which is where he was from. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure they would have come
in $1 million a year job, right? $2 million a year job.
I think so. And but looking at it long term, I don't know if Carson Beck is the number one prospect, or you know, top three quarterback prospect for 2025. If he's at Florida, who's to say? I mean, maybe he would be, but I think there is. I think he was developed really well, and I think he's in a really good system, and I think that you've really only seen success from him. I think if he started as a freshman, and from what I've heard about Carson as a freshman, because I've followed his career for a long time, is that he just wasn't ready, and I could see a team like Florida throwing a guy like that to the wolves, and his stock plummets, and so his long-term financial value plummets. And you know, waiting his turn, obviously getting his time to start, he drives a Lamborghini now, he's doing okay.
We're not gonna be able to, you know, figure out the counterfactual on it, but there's definitely some truth to this, right? I mean, look, last week we talked, okay, and so I'm coming up to my favorite story, right? Last week we talked some about how Justin Fields probably needed to take the pressure off and go play somewhere as a number two,
yeah,
and learn from a more seasoned quarterback. Okay, so obviously this has happened where he's going to play for the Pittsburgh Steelers with a ultra seasoned coach, but the dean of NFL coaches, Mike Tomlin, and Russell Wilson, a guy with Super Bowl winner, lots of experience, lots of Pro Bowls. But Doug, why it continues to be my favorite story, it was the lead story on both of the morning shows on ESPN this Monday morning, the 18th. So Get Up and First Take. I also saw a headline in USA Today saying blockbuster trade. Okay. Blockbuster. So you're laughing because you know where I'm going with this. A blockbuster trade of a sixth round pick for a backup quarterback. Only Justin Fields.
that only Justin Fields would that be considered a blockbuster trade. Kenny Pickett, not considered a blockbuster trade. Desmond Ridder, not considered a blockbuster trade. Blockbuster trade, that's like if LeBron James were traded for Victor Wembanyama or something. That's a blockbuster trade.
Rounder that, depending on playing time, could move up to a fourth rounder.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Which I don't really understand that. But I think that the field situation is going to be kind of funny because Wilson is not the veteran, I think, that he needs to be behind. We talked about last week. We talked about Aaron Rodgers. Somebody that's like surefire. Wilson, I think if he had had a decent backup, would have gotten benched with the Broncos at some point in the last 2 years. The way he's played, his performance has dropped off significantly since his time in Seattle. And then, of course, Geno Smith performed really well in Seattle, which made a lot of people question the effectiveness of Russell Wilson.
I've always got to interject with Russell Wilson, right? Because the touchdown to interception ratio, one of my favorite metrics, was very strong for him last year. There were also a ton of sacks, and I hate that kind of mistake, slow cognitive processing data point. But, man, Doug, the thing that I keep coming back to with Russell Wilson, and I think I mentioned it last week, Seattle let him go, and Denver hated him, right? So it's something that's outside of the analytics that just makes me question what is the issue there, right? What is the problem?
Yeah, I really like this stat, speaking of analytics, regarding Justin Fields and Russell Wilson. This is from Stat News NFL.
So it's the last 2 years they lead the league in
only two quarterbacks have 100 or more interceptions plus sacks taken over the last two seasons.
So Mike Tomlin assembled a quarterback room made up of the guys that make the most mistakes in the NFL.
Well, it's like, is this some kind of like reverse Moneyball thing where there's someone on the analytics crew over with the Pittsburgh Steelers and they're like, you know what an indicator of quarterback success is? It's throwing over 100 interceptions / sacks taken in a 2 year period. That is, they saw historically someone, maybe Lamar Jackson did that. Maybe I'm trying to think of like players that could have even done that. Jameis Winston was definitely on that train at one point. Eli Manning might have been, although I don't think he took that many sacks. But anyway, it's like there's some indicator of future success in a different system.
The sacks are really the key to that, right? Because it's hard to rack up five interceptions a game, but you can rack up five sacks a game. And so that's the hidden, as a running quarterback, people will argue with it in terms of that they're going to have inflated sack statistics. But those two traits, not being able to take apart the defense and put the ball where it needs to be or holding the ball too long, that might meet the if I'm looking at just a couple of metrics, I'm looking at touchdown passes, sacks, and interceptions. And so for the Pittsburgh Steelers to neglect that is interesting. Now, criticisms of Mike Tomlin, I think that's something you never hear about. No one does that, right, Doug? Does anyone do that?
You can't criticize Mike
Tomlin. Well, I'm about to. Okay. I'm not criticizing anyone. But Tomlin, a point I've made is that I think you have to look at coach quarterback pairs, right? And so Tomlin had Ben Roethlisberger. I heard a stat a fact that I didn't verify, so I'm a little sloppy here, that the Steelers haven't won a playoff game in a decade. Okay, so that makes me really concerned about Tomlin's ability without Ben Roethlisberger. And so now we've had Mitch Trubisky, we've had Kenny Pickett. Oh, you see some of those rumors that Pickett refused to dress in terms of backing up Mason Rudolph. And so it all might have been an attitude issue. But now he's brought in two guys with dubious levels of mistakes and let's say for us outsiders, Doug, and unknown levels of professionalism, right? Because there's some strange signals on both of these guys, and also a lot of public praise.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's going to be fun to watch or to follow, rather. I'll go out on a limb and say that the Steelers general manager and their front office, they're a believer that these two players are undervalued.
Well, there's like three, right?
Yeah, and so undervalued because they played behind bad offensive lines. The Steelers, I think, have probably built up their offensive line in recent years, and then when they're looking at the quarterback market, they feel like the overvalued guys are the guys who were protected and had nice stats because of it, and the undervalued guys maybe had more of those mistake type stats, the interceptions and turnover, interceptions and sacks taken. But that's largely due to the fact that they're playing behind a different line or a bad line. And so if we bring those guys into our system with our offense and our personnel, you're going to see a drastically increased performance. I can almost guarantee you that's like part of the thinking in that front office.
I love that kind of firm maybe. And like, I mean, hey, I'm not, despite all of the criticisms I've made of Justin Fields based on data, I thought he was improving last year, late in the season, particularly post-injury. And so I can definitely also imagine a scenario where Justin Fields might be the most physically talented quarterback in the league.
I think he is.
The Steelers are getting the most physically talented quarterback in the league for essentially a sixth or seventh round pick.
And a year where a first round pick might get you Bo Nix or might get you Michael Penix.
J.J. McCarthy. Right,
J.J. McCarthy. Who would you rather have, Mike? J.J. McCarthy or Justin Fields?
Yeah, bigger, faster, stronger, throws the ball farther.
And for a six-round pick, I see the argument.
And the issue with Russell Wilson, again, someone else is paying his contract. So, they're paying him the league minimum. I think $1 million. Now the Steelers were 10-7 last year, so I think you also have to ask the question of, was Kenny Pickett and Mason Rudolph, were they a -2 kind of thing? So is that a 12-5 team if you've got an adequate player? Because if you're a 12-5 team, if you've got an average player, then why didn't the Steelers sign Kirk Cousins, right?
Because Kirk Cousins costs money. Okay. I mean, Justin Fields and Russell Wilson were bargains.
Right. How about this? You go out and you sign Kirk Cousins again. You've got a 12-5 team, and then you trade for trade for Justin Fields.
I like that. I like that better. You like that? I do like that though. I like that idea. I do think Cousins just is such a perfect fit in Atlanta because I can see all of our Atlanta Falcons friends hating him for being mediocre, even though he's probably a lot better than any other option they would have turned to in the last 2 years. So I like seeing that. I think
okay, but Cousins
fit
is fun too, right, Doug? Because this is the Falcons that gave him, what, $100 million guaranteed and $180 million in total, something like that. He's also a guy that Minnesota didn't want because Minnesota prefers to draft J.J. McCarthy or Bo Nix.
Yeah, I don't like that move for Minnesota. I don't like that move for Minnesota, particularly if it's in favor of McCarthy or Nix.
Doug, I love quarterbacks.
I think these days I used to be a running back guy. That used to be the position that I just was infatuated with, but they're treated like a dime a dozen and they kind of are at this point. And so quarterbacks are really where it's at right now. And yeah, I mean, draft coming up next month or two,
April, you know,
Caleb Williams list of red flags. We've now got
Let me just frame this. Okay, so if I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, as much as I care about the NFL, I don't know that I love the moves they've made in the quarterback room, but I'll tell you what, they're interesting moves, and you could see them both playing out. It's like we're rolling the dice on two guys, which in the quarterback market, you know, when we look back at the Trevor Lawrence draft class, where 4 out of 5 guys have already essentially washed out, or 3 out of 5 guys have maybe washed out. I love this kind of risk management approach to it. But as a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, I have some hope. As a Chicago Bear fan, I got a 6th round pick for him, and I'm taking a guy that paints FU on his fingernails, cries in the stands, has interesting wardrobe choices.
For those that aren't aware, he wore a dress on GQ.
I'm sad. I'm very sad as a Bears fan.
I don't get, like, I've never been on the Caleb Williams train. I understand he's like a talented guy, but how much more talented is he than Fields? Is he five rounds of draft picks better than Justin Fields?
Is he as fast as Fields?
I doubt it.
Does he have the arm strength of Fields?
I doubt it.
Okay, so if you can't get a coach that can fix Fields, and again, maybe it's the cognitive processing, right? The sacks and the interceptions. If you can't come up with this coaching staff that can fix Fields, why do you think you can develop Caleb Williams into an NFL player? Or you just think he's ready to go. He's plug and play. He's Peyton Manning. He's generational.
I think he's like Kyler Murray. Like, I think he's good. You know, like, he's talented. He can play. And I think his ceiling is probably Russell Wilson. But the difference is Russell Wilson always struck me as a mature guy when he was younger.
Bears fans, if he turns into Kyler Murray after all this,
I think Kyler Murray would be a reasonably decent scenario for them. Oh. Because what we haven't seen from Kyler Murray is painting his fingernails, is crying in the stands, is not. I mean,
a contract clause that says he has to watch tape. We saw that.
Yeah, that's true. Caleb Williams played at Oklahoma in the Big 12, and then played at USC, the flagship school of the Pac-12. Never won a conference championship.
Former conference.
Yeah, former Pac-12. RIP. Yeah, didn't make a college football playoff. Lost the Pac-12 to Utah, and then didn't even make the Pac-12 championship the next year. Cried in the stands. Painted his fingernails. I mean, I there's so many red flags with him. If it's my team, first off, I'm a Giants guy. I will forever be grateful for Tommy DeVito, because there was a time when the Giants were favored to have the number one pick. Tommy DeVito went on his miracle run, and the Giants fell in the draft. I've never been so happy to fall in the draft.
Yeah, and it's tough, right? Because I think when we start talking about red flags or warning signals, whether it's, you know, Seattle and Denver both wanted to get rid of Russell Wilson, or the guy paints profanities on his fingernails. I think there's a natural tendency for a lot of folks to want to push back and go, you guys are supposed to be a sports analytics show. Tell me about the data. Don't get into the personality. But, you know, the reality is data is always supplemented by personality. Now, we don't get to meet these people. We don't get to do that. We don't get to see their leadership in the locker room. We don't get to see their demeanor when the team is down. And so we're relying on these heuristics, these signals that – that's why I'll look at body language. I'm not a body language expert. What right do I have to interpret the body language? But given the information set I have, I'm going to do that, right? And so again, well, Russell Wilson, man, two teams really wanted him out of town. That scares me, because I don't know why that is. Caleb Williams, there's nothing wrong with his fashion choices, but I don't know why he's doing them. Right. And so big question marks. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's totally fair. And I will say this. So BJ Novak's Ryan Howard in The Office, there's a scene where he finds out that Kelly Kapoor is going to is going to date him, and he can't believe it. And then she says, yeah, I text Daryl about it. And he was totally cool about it. Daryl, her ex, who works at the warehouse. And he was totally cool about it. And Novak's character's like, wait, what? And she's like, yeah, he didn't even fight for me. It's like a fairy tale. And Novak, you just see in his face, like, he's now learned that he is entering a bad situation. He doesn't know why, but the fact that the warehouse guy just let her go, break up over text, leaving for another man, and was happy for that to happen, is a signal that he's about to have some problems. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about with the Pittsburgh Steelers, with particularly with Russell Wilson.
Yeah, like I said, I don't know. And as a Steeler fan, I got to tell you, I'm dubious, But man, I'm looking forward to this season, Doug.
I think it'll be fun. Yeah, I think it'll be fun. they have like a pretty decent, like the fact that they won double digit games last year, Justin Fields can't say like it's just the worst team, you know, that if he was in any other franchise, he would be successful. We'll find out how he does with a decent team.
This is my level of excitement. If things start to go wrong for Russell Wilson, my backup is Justin Fields. This guy could rush for 200 yards in any game.
Yeah, run a triple option, if nothing else.
This makes the Pittsburgh Steelers the most fun team in the NFL next year. Do I question the decisions? Absolutely. Am I looking forward to watching it play out? Even more so.
I think George Pickens being a complete diva makes it all the better because we had him complaining about Pickett not getting the ball this season. I can certainly imagine him. Obviously, with the history of Fields at Georgia, I could see him being publicly critical of Fields if things aren't going well. I could see him being critical of Russell Wilson because they're, you know, that's a Gen Z kid and a millennial. I mean, they're in different generations. So your number one receiver is a diva, and you've got quarterback drama between two pretty intriguing guys, one who is a Super Bowl winning veteran, the other a former, you know, top draft pick.
The other had a TV show on Netflix as a high school senior.
Yeah, that's right. QB1.
QB1.
So, yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun in Pittsburgh this year. I think that like when training camp starts, I think ESPN is just going to be camped out.
Can we do outside of Pittsburgh? I mean, I don't know how much. Okay.
I'm there.
Okay, last item agenda for this week. Talked a little bit about it. The Next Generation Fandom Survey data is collected. Haven't gotten to taking a look at really the purpose of the survey, looking at how fandom is varying across the generations. First thing we did this year was look at potential VPs for Donald Trump. Okay, I want to say this. Okay, so all this content is at the fandomanalytics.com website. I do want to make the point that fandom is an interesting construct for politics. It's not something that people usually talk about, right? It's always, who would you vote for? What's your preference? My argument is that fandom and anti-fandom is really kind of the key to this stuff. It's having that level of passion that gets you to show up or gets you to show up because you hate Donald Trump so much. Now, Doug, as a bit of a spoiler alert, I've cut the data. I've just published something that looks at I've published the raw fandom rates. I've published the stuff across the generations and some correlations. I've got more stuff coming, and the stuff that's coming is pretty cool. But I'll tell you, I keep coming up with the answer of Tucker Carlson.
Just looking at the data, he's the guy.
At the data, did you see that one coming?
I mean, no, but we're talking about, you know, Donald Trump as a presidential candidate. I mean, nothing's off the table.
The Apprentice and the WWE. And
So, I mean, it's like what would be surprising at this point? I'm curious, do you think that his campaign, do you think that they're kind of seeing the same indicators that you are in terms of one candidate maybe having more fandom than the rest of the potential options?
Well, I'll say this, and again, I don't know what they look at, because in some ways, politics is fun because there's so many different dimensions you can slice and dice the data on. And look, we don't even know if Tucker Carlson wants to be a vice presidential candidate, right? That dude might be making $15-20 million a year as a media figure, and operating via X.
TCN. Tucker Carlson Network. Yeah. On X. Yeah.
I'll say this, but the thing is, I dig into the data. Trump is such a, it's probably overkill to say he's a unique candidate. But Trump's the correlation in terms of preferences from like the 8 or 9 folks we're looking at with Trump is lower than it is within the group of Tim Scott, Elise Stefanik, Ron DeSantis, et cetera. Trump is a very different thing from Trump's not a Republican, right? Trump is Trump, and he has brought a lot of the Republicans with him. So
to that point, Trump, for however long ago it was when he was first running, he seemed, and he would not refuse the idea of running as a third party if he were not given the nomination as a Republican. So it's, I think the Republican Party is a vehicle for him to the White House.
It's almost a convenience.
Right.
But if Trump is not really a Republican, then a guy like Tucker Carlson that does really well and compared to, like, he's not a politician. That might be why he has higher fandom rates, because as a media figure, he ends up being more likable than some of these other folks. But yeah. He does out of that entire. So the group of Republicans includes stuff like Vivek Ramaswamy, again, in a fun one, Elise Stefanik, Kristi Noem, Tulsi Gabbard. I pulled all the names from one of these.
Ben Carson was on there.
Ben Carson, Ron DeSantis. DeSantis actually ends up being the safe candidate. If you look across generations, Tucker Carlson does great across all the generations, but particularly with the younger folks. Probably a little bit surprising, DeSantis actually does better amongst the older traditional folks. And so there's lots of ways for the Trump team to consider this. But across every one of these guys, every one of these analysis, Carlson's strong. I mean, I'm a little surprised.
Yeah, I'm surprised by that too. And I'll be really curious to see, you know, if that's something Trump's campaign taps into. I mean, not specifically your research, but if there's some parallels in what they're looking at and if it informs their decision in the way that, you know, the numbers seem to suggest it would.
Well, I'll say this. If I'm the Trump campaign, Tucker Carlson is essentially the home run, right? He's got the broadest appeal. He does better in some groups that Trump doesn't do great in. He's
also media, a little like attack dog. Like,
yeah, he's clearly can communicate, so he's media savvy.
Yeah.
I also think that DeSantis is actually the safe pick, right? Like, who knows if Tucker Carlson can campaign?
I feel like DeSantis and Trump have too much like bad blood at this point after and the that other campaign.
The other name that comes across. So there's four names that I considered possibilities after looking at the data. DeSantis is the safe guy. Carlson is probably the best pick. Vivek Ramaswamy, if your goal is to just have a new movement, essentially take the Republican Party from where it is and essentially make it Trump Ramaswamy going forward, that movement kind of approach. In terms of the other candidates, if like there's a notion you need a female candidate, because that's what we do in America in 2024, all about demographics. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was actually the top scoring one. And that kind of surprised me too. I would have thought that she would have came in behind the Kristi Noems and the Elise Stefanics. Maybe it's a
brand. I'm guessing you left Nikki Haley off the list.
I did. And I went back.
I mean, it makes sense. It makes sense too.
I went back and forth on that simply because it would have been nice to see how she, I had her featured in some earlier research. She had amazingly high negatives. So I was not surprised at how this turned out. But given the focus on the VP, that just didn't seem like anything that was going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to see how much the fandom numbers correlate with the results that we end up seeing, even come election time, how predictive it is of, you know, how Americans are going to behave in the fall. And because, you know, reading the article, it seems like you're tapping into something in that, just like with sports fandom, you know, I'm not likely to change from being a Celtics guy to a Lakers guy because of, you know, something small. And I think that most supporters are that way. But there's a subset of people in America that go back and forth that are swinging these things, or maybe it's just
okay
deciding to vote or not.
I love what you said. If something small happens, I think that's the key to fandom. You're not going to switch if something big happens.
Okay, well, that's fair.
Penn State. That,
like Penn State. Yeah. We were going the same direction with that. I remember being astounded seeing their first whiteout after that whole debacle. And, you know, it is really amazing. And even being from Alabama, seeing Alabama football fans, you know, rally around this new coach, DeBoer from Washington. Who would have thought a year ago that, you know, the Nick Saban homers would think that a guy, you know, the Washington head coach might be the best coach in the country and the guy they'd most want to pull for. But here we are. And so you see it in sports, and I think we'll see it in politics.
Remember when Calipari went from Louisville to Kentucky? The about fan base?
Okay. Well, I mean, Nick Saban was an LSU guy before Alabama. I mean, that's their big rival.
Okay, and the last one, just it'll probably be out there in a few days after we post the podcast. I've even done this analysis, and it's going to sound silly what I did at first, but I think it's relevant when you think it through. I did it in terms of Swifties and anti-Swifties as well, the preference for these candidates. Again, sounds silly, but Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce's endorsements, that was a meaningful storyline during the Super Bowl. But even if you get beyond that, just think in terms of sort of cultural forces and cultural preferences as like a personality variable. And I'll tell you this. I mean, I won't give you the result. You guys can look for it on the website. The Taylor Swift, the Swiftie, and the anti-Swiftie fandom is really interesting in terms of how it plays out across all the candidates, especially when you get to a comparison of Biden and Trump.
Yeah, I got to check that out. I think I know, but I'll be curious.
I think you kind of know, but I don't think you totally know, because I didn't see this one coming. Okay, everyone, thanks for listening. Like I said, more content at fandomanalytics.com.